Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, scientists, astronomers, planetary scientists, and also just people who are just plain fans of space exploration and astronomy, all of these folks are very excited by the potential of NASA's most recent mission to Mars. It landed on January 3rd. They've landed a rover there called Spirit, and the mission there is to determine if Mars ever had water and could have supported life. This morning, we'll talk a little bit about this current mission, and also look back to the some of the experiences that scientists had as they designed and built and ran the first off-roading robot to land on Mars. That was called Sojourner. This was back in 1997. And our guest for this morning, Andrew Mishkin, has been involved in both of these projects, in the Sojourner mission and also the one that's going on right now. He's a senior systems engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he has coordinated the development of various robotic vehicles and their subsystems, and has been involved in that work now for more than 15 years. He joined the Sojourner rover team when it was being put together, and he eventually led the rover operations team and also commanded the rover during its exploration of Mars. In 1997, he received the NASA Exceptional Achievement Medal. He is the author of a newly published book that's titled Sojourner, An Insider's View of the Mars Pathfinder Mission. It is published by Berkeley Books, which is a division of Penguin. It's out now in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome here on the show. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Mishkin, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
I read that the NASA website, the rover website, has now gotten over a billion hits, and that is more than a third of the traffic on all of NASA's websites for all of last year. So obviously people are very interested in this particular mission. Does that level of interest surprise you, or would you say, oh, no, it doesn't surprise me at all, given the fact that Mars is something that's always fascinated us?
Well, I'm not too surprised because, of course, it's a great place to go and see the newest images that have come down, and I know we're pretty excited about it, but with so much else going on in the world, it's hard to predict just how much interest there'll be any given day or month.
How much better, let's just maybe we can make a comparison between Sojourner and Spirit. How much better is the image quality that you can get with Sojourner that you get with Spirit? I want to make sure I try not to get these guys confused. How much better is the kind of images that you can get from the Spirit if you compare that to what you got with Sojourner?
Well, the best comparison to make is between the main cameras on actually the Pathfinder lander that took images of Sojourner versus the cameras that are on a tall mast on the Spirit rover. And the cameras we have on the new mission have about three times the resolution, and of course a whole set of color filters, and so they're pretty spectacular. And then the Sojourner cameras themselves were actually used primarily just for navigation and were quite low resolution, and this particular new rover, between all of the stereo vision that's on board, the paired cameras so we can see in 3D, there's nine different cameras instead of the three that were on Sojourner. So we've really got the imaging covered this time.
So it is a great advancement in terms of what it can see and the kind of information it can collect.
And one other aspect is that this camera, the panoramic camera, or PanCam, that takes the best pictures is now on the rover itself, and so we take it with us wherever we go, where with the Pathfinder mission, the best cameras were on the lander and had to stay stationary while the rover moved around and got image. So even as we get far away from where we've landed, we're still going to be getting pictures that are great.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to read some of the aspects of the story of Sojourner and how this came together. And when you go right back to the beginning to the effort to design something that would do this, there wasn't a lot of money to start and design something from the ground up. So what happened was there were a couple of rovers that had been built with the idea of sending them to the moon, and they never went, and they got stuck away someplace. In fact, it's probably miraculous that they didn't end up being junked at somewhere along the line. And that was what you all started with, something that that already existed and had been designed for a mission that had never gone.
That's very true. In fact, these were rovers that that were built as prototypes to go on the Surveyor missions to the moon that were going to prove that it was safe for astronauts to land on the moon. And the funding for those rovers after they were built and delivered to JPL pretty much dried up. And there was, in fact, one technician at JPL who hid one of the rovers away. And every time his supervisor came across the rover, he'd say, "Oh, this is a piece of junk. We don't need it anymore. Let's just toss it out. We need this space for other things." And instead of doing that, this technician, his name was Howard Primus, took the rover and just put it in another storage place and hid it away. So he played this shell game for like 10 years. Every time some other manager found the rover and wanted it thrown out, he hid it. And finally, after 10 years, people were interested again.
I love that story. I love that story that the guy thought, "No, this is something valuable. We shouldn't just throw it away. So I'll tuck it away here." And then every time someone would come along and say, "Oh, get rid of this," he'd take it and he'd stick it away someplace else. So it's I guess to his tribute that that when a time came to design this new rover, that the old one was still there and hadn't long gone to the junk heap.
And it's even possible that if he hadn't done that, JPL would not really be in the rover business now, and there might never have even been a Sojourner or even a Spirit rover. Yeah, that's just the ins and outs of history.
Well, how like this rover that was designed to go to the moon, that started out to be the one that we worked on, how alike or how different is that from what Sojourner eventually turned out to be?
Well, it is similar in that they're both six-wheeled vehicles, but that they both are very capable in terms of being able to, to give you an idea, either Sojourner or pretty much this other test rover could go over obstacles that are about 1.5 times as high as its wheels, and that would be like taking your car and driving over your dining room table. I mean, that's the scale. And, of course, people have trouble driving over a curb, so it really shows the capability. So there were similarities in capability, but we needed to come up with something that we could package very tightly and that would be very reliable. And so there was a very different suspension system that was eventually designed by an engineer named Don Bickler that is what really led to the Sojourner design.
Well, that's one of the there was a lot of attention at the time and a fair amount of space in the book devoted to this particular subject, that is how it is that you design the suspension system that's going to be an important part of how this thing gets around. And I suppose really when you think about it, if something happened and the Sojourner had tipped over, that would have been the end of the mission.
Well, that's true. But on the other hand, we design in sensors so that we can detect if we're anywhere near rollover. And these vehicles, in particular, their suspension is very stable, so that even if the vehicle was tilted about 45 degrees, it would still be perfectly stable. And at that point, we would, again, stop because of what we had sensed and could back out of a situation before it got any worse. Mm-hmm. So we need both the the brawn of the suspension system and the design of the rover and the brain to tell us, you know, not to do something stupid.
People, if they sort of think about this idea of that it's this remote control vehicle, they, as a model in their minds, they might think of, the little radio-controlled cars that you can go down and buy at Radio Shack, and that it would be like driving that. But it's not anything like that, is it?
No, and one of the main reasons that it isn't is because the speed of light just isn't really fast enough. It takes so long to get a message to Mars and back that, for example, if we had images coming back as the rover was driving along and we saw a cliff that the rover was headed towards and we wanted to issue the command to say, okay, well, stop. Well, by the time we even received the pictures that showed us that hazard, 10 minutes would have gone by, and the rover would have gone over that cliff and would be sitting at the bottom upside down. And so no matter how loud we yelled stop, it would be too late. So we need to design a way of commanding the rovers that that doesn't depend on that direct communications. And so we do two things. One is we design our commands for everything the rover is going to do to cover an entire day of operations, and then send those up in the morning and let the rover go out and execute them. And we build the smarts on board so that the rover can, on its own, detect those hazards and avoid them or stop. And so it takes a lot more than just joysticking a rover.
Yeah.
That's what we usually imagine.
Well, that's an important point, I think, for people to understand, that it's just elevates the complexity that much more because of this time lag between commands and execution, that the rover itself has to be smart enough to know not to go over a cliff.
Right. And another way to think about it is that we plan what the rover is going to do while the rover is sleeping, and then we send up the commands when the rover wakes up, and the drivers of the rover are actually sleeping while the rover is driving, because we go home and we go to sleep and rest up for the next day while the commands are being executed.
How did you get involved in Sojourner in the first place?
Well, when I first came to JPL, I stumbled across some of these early rover research efforts. In fact, using the rover you described earlier, which was the one that was built for potential use on the moon, and we started adapting those to try to come up with these technologies for how do you navigate a rover. And we did some very early work with that Surveyor rover and demonstrated that those things could work. And again, this is really shoestring budget kind of work that was going on, because nobody was that interested at the time. And things just kind of evolved from there. And then once we got to a certain point where this mission was going to exist and a real rover was going to be built, people at JPL, the management, pretty much deputized a bunch of us researchers into working on the flight rover, because they looked around and there weren't any people who had done a spacecraft rover up to that point. So the best we had were our researchers, and so we adapted and we learned how to do spacecraft.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Andrew Mishkin. He's a senior systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and he's been working now for a number of years on the development of robotic vehicles and their subsystems. He was very much involved in the designing and building and operating the rover that went to Mars in 1997. That one was called Sojourner, and it was named for Sojourner Truth. He has continued to be involved in this kind of work, and he also has been very much involved in the current generation of Mars rovers, the one that Spirit, the one that is on Mars now, and another one, and I apologize, I now have forgotten the name of the second one that's going to be landing soon.
Opportunity.
And when is that expected to land?
Well, that lands January 24th, so that's coming up pretty quickly.
And how are those, are the two rovers essentially the same, and just the idea is that they're going to explore two different areas?
That's correct. They're as identical as we could build them to be, and they carry the same instruments, but they are going to very different sites that both potentially have evidence that there might have been water at those sites.
Our questions are welcome here on the show. In fact, we have somebody here ready to go. We will get to our phone number 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Belgium over by Danville on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have heard, and I don't know the, I just by way of different things, that you can actually see a three-dimensional image of Mars if you use these glasses you used to use when you were a kid to watch three-dimensional stuff, the red and the blue one. Is that true?
Yes, that's true, and we have images like that on the website for our mission. And that's basically we take two images with our cameras, a left eye image and a right eye image, and then we basically put them into appropriate colors so that you'll see one image with one eye and one with the other when you put on those red-blue glasses.
And so you can
those are available.
And it's actually just like you're sitting there right with the rover, huh?
Pretty much. It also shows us a lot when we see them in 3D because the first images we got back from the landing site made it look like it was very flat. And when you look in 3D, you can actually see that there are these dips and depressions and rises that really stand out in 3D, and you can see that it's not quite as flat as it looked the first time. So that's very important for us in our planning of how to navigate the rover to be able to see things in 3D like that.
I see. And one other question: when I see these pictures on television, it looks like the horizon is going uphill. Is that really fact, or is this sitting in the bottom of a depression, or is that just the way it is?
Well, some of the pictures that were taken were taken after we had tilted the lander a little bit as part of our work to try to reel in some of the airbag material and get it out of the way for our driving. And a result of that was that what is really a very level area in some of the pictures does look tilted. But if you look at the entire panorama, you'll see that it's actually very level. In fact, right after landing, we checked how level the lander was, and it was only tilted about 2 degrees from being perfectly level.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm glad the call raised this issue because I think that, again, it's interesting to think about the challenges of being able to see the Martian landscape the way we would see it if we were standing there, to be able to judge things like depth, and that you have to be able to do that when you're planning out where the rover is going to go, because again, you got to be concerned about what the terrain is like, and is it going to go over a big rock, or is it going to go down into a depression or something like that. And to do that, you do indeed have to manipulate the image, be able to produce a kind of an image that has dimension, because otherwise just looking at a flat image on a flat screen is just not going to do it for you.
Well, that's absolutely correct. If we had just a single image, like if you were just looking with one eye at the terrain and you couldn't move, there's really no way to be sure that some rock that you see might not be either very small but very near to you, or very, you know, big but far away. And so by having stereo vision, having two eyes, we're able to actually triangulate and know very precisely how far away and how large objects are and how big a dip would be, so that we can come up with commands that say drive, you know, exactly, you know, 3.2 yards straight ahead, then make a turn of 30 degrees and continue for this many yards, so that we can design a path that will go to what we're interested in and avoid what might be hazardous.
If people have been following this, I think one of the things that they've seen is that once the rover, once the whole thing landed, it was on the surface and it was kind of unwrapped and ready to go, that the business of getting it ready to roll off its platform and actually go was really fairly involved and took some time and care. And it seemed to be the kind of thing that the scientists who were working on the project did not want to rush. Why is it that that stage is so complicated? I guess, again, as I would think about it as a layperson, you would think that once it was down and unfolded and ready to go, you just roll it right off, and there you are on the surface of Mars. But apparently it's not that easy.
Right, and in fact, in the case of Sojourner, we were able to drive off on the second day on Mars, and there wasn't too much that we had to do. And in that case, we had a much simpler design from the standpoint of kind of unfurling the rover. In the case of Spirit, the way I look at it is we have three major kind of risky aspects to our mission. There's launch, there's doing our entry, descent, and landing on Mars, which we all held our breath on, and then there's driving off the lander. And in some ways, once we're on the surface, the lander itself is one of our bigger hazards because we have to drive off a major step of the lander to get onto the surface. And because we've just landed, we don't have a lot of imagery of like what's right underneath the lander, what's right next to us, because we're sitting on top of a lot of it. In addition, this rover had to be folded up very, very intricately for us to be able to fit it into the lander. And the term I've heard on our project a lot is that we're doing reverse origami to open up the rover and get it to its full size and all of its components deployed. And so that has been part of what's taking time, a combination of opening that and also clearing the path for us to drive off. Hmm. After we landed, we noticed, and you probably can see in the pictures, airbag material that cushioned our landing that's sticking up on different sides of the lander. And even though that material is pretty soft, we don't want to drive through it if we can avoid it, because it might, for example, get caught on one of our delicate solar panels and might damage it. And so we just want to avoid it if we can. So the things we've gone through have involved trying to pull in those airbags, get them out of the way, which is actually something we also did on the Pathfinder mission. And then also this, once we've done that and moved the pedals that we landed on around to make it easier to do that, once we've completed that, we've gone through the step of standing the rover up and unfolding its front wheels, which start out almost in a praying position, and we stand up, and then we swing these wheels out, and it's so tightly confined, the volume is so tight, that we actually have to turn the wheels and steer them out of the way as we're swinging them up and out so they don't make contact with our solar array, lock those in place, make sure they're locked, then extend out our rear wheels. We have to cut cables. There's a whole set of things to do that also derive from the fact that the brain on this rover is the brain of the lander. That Sojourner was its own little spacecraft, and there was a lander brain. In this case, all of the electronics that operated us through space, through landing, and now will operate the rover are one and the same. And so once we cut the cable, the lander is just like a dead hulk, a piece of space debris, and we drive off. So all of those different aspects have contributed to why this takes time. And we've chosen to be very careful with what we consider a very valuable asset.
Mm-hmm. When you think about landing a complicated scientific instrument like this on the surface of the moon or another planet, I'm sure that one of the things that occupies people is how do we get this thing down without damaging it? But in the case of these rovers, I think, and there was a different approach taken, which did involve the use of these airbags, where the package was actually just slammed right into the planet, which you'd think would be sort of counterintuitive. What you'd think you'd want to do is put it down as gently as you possibly could. Whose idea was it to take this unusual approach and to say, well, why don't we just pad it so it will take the shock of landing and just drop it?
Well, this idea was actually somewhat of an old idea, and of course it was used on Pathfinder and proven on Pathfinder. And it's not exactly just slamming the spacecraft into the planet. There's a little more to it. For example, while it's true that we don't go into orbit around the planet like the Viking missions did, we come straight into the atmosphere. We're first slowed down by an aeroshell and a heat shield in a similar way as you remember the Apollo missions coming back had a heat shield and they'd come into the atmosphere and that would slow them down. We do the same thing, so that's actually a very traditional approach. We come in, that slows us down from like 12,000 miles an hour down to about 1,000 miles an hour. At that point, we have a parachute that comes out that slows us further. And then, as we do certain other deployments, we reach a point where we actually are only perhaps 100 feet or so above the surface, and we fire rockets that actually bring us to a complete halt. So we're actually, for an instant, effectively hanging over the surface, and then we inflate our airbags, and we drop like the last 50 feet or so and bounce. And so it's only really the velocity that we built up during that relatively short drop that we really have to deal with the airbags. And the advantage, again, of using the airbags is that we can handle rocks that are 3 feet tall and survive them. And if we did a landing with a powered lander coming straight down, we might come right down on a rock and puncture the lander. So there are risks doing it by almost any approach. The way that we've done it does allow us to survive a lot of different encounters with rocks. There are future missions that go back to landing in a more deliberate powered landing, but those are starting to look at having more intelligence on board to be able to look down and say, well, that's a rock that I don't want to touch down next to. Let's move over to the left or move over to the right and start adding that kind of guidance. But as long as we don't have that, this seemed to be one of the less risky approaches to take.
I don't know if you and people there like to use a word like luck, but even with the kind of packaging that you have around the lander and the effort to slow it down to a mere 1,000 miles an hour, is there some luck involved in where it is that you actually make contact with the surface?
Well, there is always a certain amount of luck when it comes to landing on Mars. We have designed things as well as we can, but even if every single aspect of our landing on Mars has worked perfectly, which it actually did seem to do for Spirit, there's always the chance that there will be that pointed rock, that there will be very high winds that would increase our velocity so that we basically come skidding across the landscape. Those things can happen, and people can argue over what are the chances of success overall. I usually believe that on the order, there's always about a 10% chance that something could go wrong just based on what the environment of Mars is, even if our spacecraft works absolutely perfectly. So yes, I think there is always a certain amount of luck involved, and we may be engineers and scientists, but we're not going to turn down getting some of that luck.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here, and we have another caller we'll get right to, and I guess I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Andrew Mishkin. He's a senior systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And now for a number of years, he's been working on the development of various robotic vehicles. One of those that he was involved in was called Sojourner, and that was the one that was landed on Mars in 1997 as part of the Pathfinder mission. And he's also been involved in the current mission that has landed Spirit, and Opportunity is the other one that's going to land in about I guess about 10 days or so, maybe a little bit more than that. If you're interested, by the way, in reading about how it is that Sojourner was developed, he's written a book on this. It's titled Sojourner, An Insider's View of the Mars Pathfinder Mission, and it's published by Berkeley, which is a division of Penguin. Questions are welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, use that one. It's 800-222-9455. We do have someone here on the toll-free line in Herrick, and we'll go right there. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. I noticed that the running gear on this is nothing at all like what we have developed for ATVs commercially in the United States, and I just kind of wondered what influenced your design for the running gear, and what advantages you see over the more common types of ATV layouts.
Well, I'm not the mechanical engineering expert, but I can give you a partial answer to that. The rocker bogey design that that is used on Spirit and was also used on Sojourner makes the vehicle very stable. The vehicle can be tilted 45 degrees and it'll remain stable. When the wheels can basically move up and down and therefore stay on the surface even when the terrain is very rough, and in fact the main body of the rover will only move about half as much as the wheels do up and down. So it keeps the platform that our instruments and our electronics are in very, very stable. And that was really one of the driving factors there. In addition, we can go over obstacles that for the size of the vehicle are much larger than for any kind of standard vehicle. In fact, the designer of the rocker bogey suspension, Don Bickler, was inspired by looking at a Jeep that his son bought at one point years ago, and he went and he said, "Well, I wonder how this, what they're doing with the design to make it stable." And he went and he studied it, and he said, "Boy, I could do better than that." And he went off and on his own mostly started looking at ways to make a more stable suspension. And that's why we have this design today.
So it is kind of a development from the old Jeep-style suspension, then.
Well, it was inspired by what the old-style suspensions couldn't do, and so in that sense, yes, it's also was inspired by that Surveyor lunar rover prototype that was delivered in the early 60s and a book that was written by the developer of that about how to design suspensions that talked about the uses of bogies rather than springs, because most of the suspensions that are used commercially use springs, and this design doesn't do that at all. It uses linkages to maintain the stability.
Well, thank you. Thank you much.
All right.
Well,
thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, would be a long-distance call. Or actually, people listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, can also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. There was another, people were interested in another probe. This one was built by Britain. It was called Beagle 2, and it was expected to touch down on Mars on Christmas Day. And it apparently it has been lost, and I guess no one's really exactly sure what happened. What is the current thought now about what happened to Beagle, or does anybody really have any idea what happened to it?
Well, I can't speak for that mission and their theories. All I can say is that just as with the Mir mission, landing on Mars is a risky and difficult thing, and I know that we've been trying to make contact with Beagle since its landing, and that there has been no indication of any message from it. So It could have, you know, any number of things could have happened. Its airbags could have been punctured by the unfortunate pointed rock. It could have, you know, rolled into a location that from which it couldn't communicate, and there could have been a reset of its clock. That was, in fact, a problem that we had when we eventually lost the Pathfinder mission, where our batteries finally went dead, and we had an incorrectly set clock, so we didn't know on board how to point our antennas towards the Earth, because where the Earth would be in the sky on Mars would depend on what was the time of day. There's any number of things, and I'm sure they have a long list on the Beagle mission that they have been assessing. But it's you know, it's unfortunate. I would still hope we would hear from them, because you know, the more different explorers we have on Mars, the more we're going to learn. Hmm.
Well, what was it that Beagle was intended to do, and how was that different from what the Spirit and Opportunity are interested in?
Well, Beagle 2 was intended as a life detection experiment, and in fact, it had a robotic arm on it, and it would look for signs of life that were literally within reach of the lander. They didn't have a rover on board, so what they would do is they would reach this arm out, place instruments against soil or rock that was in reach. They had a device they called a mole that would potentially kind of burrow into the soil and, again, attempt to look for signs of life. The MER missions and Spirit and Opportunity are really designed to look for the past presence of water on Mars and to try to determine whether the environment might have been conducive to life in the past. And again, also by having a mobile platform, the intent is to be able to drive to different targets, to different rocks and soil, and to geological features that are distinct, and basically reach out and touch those and get very close views to, in fact, even grind off some of the surfaces of rocks that have been weathered and look underneath at the part that isn't weathered to look at the differences and look at the structure of those rocks, again, in order to determine whether those might have been formed or have existed in the presence of water in the past.
Hmm. Well, we have some other folks to talk with here. Let's talk next with someone listening in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about how the navigation is done from a standpoint of how much of it is using, you know, self-navigation by the rover, artificial intelligence for collision avoidance, or, you know, earlier you said we give it a command of go 3.2 yards forward, and is it send a command like that and then wait till it acknowledges back, or do you say I want to go over there and let it find its way?
Well, it's really a combination. If we are in, if we are trying to do some tight moves very close to something, we may specify very precisely go this many inches and turn this far. We can do that if we wanted to maybe do a very final terminal alignment on a target. If we want to cover long distances where we want to go beyond what those of us on Earth can see looking at the images, and we're going to be trusting the greater knowledge that the vehicle will have based on the imaging it can take, then we can use our auto-navigation system, which actually takes images and creates a very local map of what's in front of the rover, and then it on board will plan a path that is the safest path through that map. And then it will move forward 30 centimeters or so, and then do this again. And so it continually looks for what's safe, given a proposed target that is far out there, and it will deviate as much as necessary to stay on a safe path as it tries to approach that target. So we have both approaches available to us, and we'll use them based on different circumstances.
Okay. Great, thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to the next caller, and they're in Tuscola, line two. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you go through some kind of decontamination of your vehicle to ensure that spores and pollen and bacteria and viruses aren't taken with you until it on the lander, and then when it gets there, it will then spread throughout the plant. Is that a concern you guys go through?
It's definitely a concern. Every one of our missions to Mars has to deal with what we call planetary protection and avoiding contamination of where we're going. What we don't want to do in the future is send a mission to do something like detect life and then detect life we brought with us.
Right.
And we certainly don't want to impact the environment that might exist on Mars if there is some type of life that might exist there. So we have all during our building up of our vehicles, we go through a process. We work in clean rooms to minimize the number of spores and other particles. We go through a cleaning process. We do assays to check as to what the number of spores and other items are that have settled onto the spacecraft to make sure that it falls within the specified limits so that nothing will contaminate the planet. We actually seal up the inside of the rover because it's not always easy to clean electronics as much as we would like, so we seal that up and actually have HEPA filters between the inside and the outside so anything that might be inside is kept inside. So there's a number of things that we do in order to avoid any type of contamination.
Does the radiation in space kill a lot of the spores and stuff on the outside skin as it's traveling to Mars?
I'm sure that it does. We don't depend on that for this. We know that at the time that we launch, we have to make sure that the number of spores is small enough that it's within our bounds. So we don't count on that scouring by the radiation of space. Mm-hmm. We also do other things like make sure that the other stages that have launched us towards Mars are not going to impact the surface. So, for example, the upper stage that sends us on our way to Mars mm-hmm. won't hit Mars itself, but will miss Mars so that it wouldn't contaminate either.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. If you have a question, you can call. Our guest is Andrew Mishkin. He's senior systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was involved in the Pathfinder mission of 1997 that sent the rover Sojourner to Mars, and also has been continued involved in that same kind of work, and also was very much involved in the current project, which has sent two rovers. One has already touched down and is on Mars. That's Spirit. And then there's another called Opportunity. That's due to land on January 25th. People are obviously fascinated with this. And if you're interested, by the way, in looking at some of the images and learning more about this, you can go to the NASA website if you have internet access and learn all about it there. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. One of the things that I want to ask you that I think I have read a mention of in many, many of the articles that I've looked at about this is about how the time on Mars is different from the time on the Earth, and so the scientists who are doing this work have to live on Mars time. What does that mean, living on Mars time?
Well, as you indicated, the Mars day is a different length. It's just about 40 minutes longer than an Earth day. And because the rover is solar-powered and basically wakes with the sun and operates during the day and will tend to shut down in the late afternoon, we all have to work on that schedule as well in order to have our commands ready to send up when the rover wakes up and to look at the data that's coming back while the rover's operating. And what that means is that, for example, I get up every morning 40 minutes later in order to go into work, because that's when my shift starts, 40 minutes later every day. A number of us have Mars time watches because it turns out that during the mission, it's more important for us to know what time it is on Mars than what time it is on Earth. And so I have a watch that's been slowed down so it keeps Mars time, and that way I know when I need to go into work to do my job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be a little disorienting because the only people living on Mars time are those of us on the project, and so we can lose track of what's going on in the outside world. In some ways, it's like living on a submarine. We have a close-knit group of people who are living in the same time zone, but nobody else is. And then when opportunity lands, it will be on the opposite side of Mars, and as a result, it will be in a different Martian time zone. And so we will not then have two teams going, both on Mars time, but living in different time zones.
Mm.
And so that's going to be a continuing interesting experience. We went through it on Pathfinder for about a month after Sojourner began operating. And so I've done it before, but each time it's a major challenge.
How long did it take you to get back to Earth time?
To get used to Earth time?
To get used to Earth time again, I guess that's what I meant,
it,
yeah.
It doesn't take too long because then you just sleep a long time and you get up. It's like jet lag.
Oh, okay.
It's like having Martian jet lag.
Martian jet lag. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have somebody on a mobile phone, a car phone here, line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, hey, I have a question. I seen a while back on television, one of public TV shows, they were showing somewhere on the face of Mars, they had like a image or a face, and also had like a tube in it, like maybe a transportation tube. Have you guys come across anything like that?
Could you? Did you, Andrew? Did you hear the question?
Well,
the caller was asking.
I think I heard part of it.
Well, I think what he was asking about was the famous face on Mars. This image that people have seen. That's it. Maybe have seen photographs of a feature on the surface of Mars that looks very much like a face, as viewed from a long way up, and some people thought, well, that's pretty interesting. Maybe that's something that actually had been constructed. But I think that what happened was is that as we'd gotten the ability to take better and better pictures of the same area with better and better resolution, that it was very clear that it was just a natural formation, and it looked like a face, sort of, from far enough away. But when you looked up close, it was obvious that it wasn't. That actually, it was obvious that it wasn't something that people had made. That it was just a formation, a natural geological formation, and that was that.
Yeah, that was our experience. That by taking images also at different times of day, as our orbiters flew over, it would look very different. And that's very normal. That there are things that we see that it's very easy for us to look at that and say, well, that looks like something, and. And then at different angles, we find that that it looks very different. And I know that's what we discovered, that we specifically did take orbital imagery of that face and did find that out.
Yeah. And actually, if people are interested in this, just not very long ago on Focus 580, we talked with a writer and astronomer named Ken Crosswell, who has just done a book titled Magnificent Mars, which is a big coffee table size book that is full of some really stunning photographs of Mars. And as I recall, there are photographs of that area that we're talking about here that you can see with the proper kind of resolution and shadowing what it looks like, and that face kind of phenomenon disappears when you get a better look at it. So if that's something you're curious about, you might look at that book. It's recently been published, and if you're interested in space and astronomy, it's just a fascinating book. It's got a lot of just really stunning pictures in it. I don't know. Have you seen that book?
I haven't seen it, but, I haven't had time to look into it.
You've been busy, I know. You've been busy. Well, I want to thank the last caller. Let's go to somebody else here. We're pretty close to the end, but we'll try to take one more call. Crystal Lake, line 4.
Yeah, I don't believe this is just research on the minerals and rocks and if there's a drop of water. I think it's primarily for militarization in space and commercialization. It's long been 90% allocated to NASA for militarization, and I think it's going to rebound and hurt us. What we need is applying our technology and supplying clean water and a healthy environment on this land.
Well, that's the kind of argument that you hear fairly often, and I got to jump in because we just don't have a lot of time, but I wonder, Mr. Mishkin, I'm sure this is the kind of thing that you hear a lot from people that say, well, you know, maybe exploring space as well, but it costs a lot of money, and we have a lot of problems to deal with on the Earth, and maybe it's just not that important.
Well, everybody has a different philosophy. I know my view of it is I find doing exploration to be very inspiring, and rather than always be, you know, focused on some of the awful things that go on around us in our day-to-day life and in the news, this is something that allows us to look outwards and to look forward as to what's possible and to inspire ourselves and others in the future, and that's really what brings me to it. And I think what brings the entire team to it. We have a lot of people who work very hard, for example, on this mission, many long hours, because of how important they felt doing the exploration has been. We all have different views, but I know that's what it is for me.
Well, you know, we're going to have to stop. There's a lot of other things that we could talk about, but we'll have to leave it there. For people who are interested in learning something about how these rovers were developed, particularly the one that went in 1997, Sojourner, you can look at this book that we mentioned by our guest, Andrew Mishkin. It's titled Sojourner, An Insider's View of the Mars Pathfinder Mission. Andrew Mishkin is Senior Systems Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.